connects the launch crew to living quarters, a power station, and an escape tunnel so the two-person missile crew can get out after launch. Most of the space down in the silo is consumed by a Minuteman III missile, 60 feet tall, 80,000 pounds, and with a 300-kiloton thermonuclear weapon in its nose cone, a weapon that is now being readied for launch. The clock reads 1:27 p.m. local time when the clarion call sounds. Combat missile crews and support personnel assigned to the 90th Missile Wing leap from their seats in every outpost across the state, each person moving at speeds only DEFCON 1 can incentivize. America's 400 land-based ICBMs are generally accepted as the leg of the U.S. nuclear triad most vulnerable to attack, because their locations are publicly known and don't change. This also makes them among the first weapon systems to be launched in a nuclear counterattack, a concept known to insiders as the use them or lose them strategy. Launch your ICBMs fast or expect them to be targeted and destroyed. An ICBM can be launched, meaning the time it takes from the moment a launch order is received to the weapon's physical launch, faster than any other weapon system in the arsenal, including those on submarines. "They weren't called Minutemen for nothing," wrote former ICBM launch officer Bruce Blair. "The process of arming and targeting and firing the missiles happens in a grand total of 60 seconds. Each of the 400 ICBM silos, like Echo 01, is strategically positioned across America, west of the Mississippi River, in Montana, Wyoming, North Dakota, Nebraska, and Colorado. They've been built beneath private ranches, inside national forests, on Native American reservations, and family farms. Some are outside small towns, others down the road from local mini malls. A few facilities are so remotely located, it takes missile crews several hours to get there by vehicle on good weather days. Missile Alert Facility Echo 01 sits inside a 9,600 square mile parcel that makes up Wyoming's vast underground nuclear missile field. "If Wyoming were a nation," journalist Dan Whipple points out, "F.E. Warren Air Force Base outside Cheyenne would make it one of the world's major nuclear powers." At Missile Alert Facility Echo 01, the two-man missile crew has been preparing every day for this day. During each morning's elevator ride down, the launch officers remove their Air Force patches from a Velcro strip and replace them with patches from Strategic Command. In the event of nuclear war, they report directly to the STRATCOM commander. For seven decades, this act has been preparatory. Today, it is real. Now that the president's launch order has been validated, the ICBM launch sequence begins. A Minuteman Launch Control Center controls 10 ICBMs. Across Wyoming, launch crews inside missile silos receive encrypted orders. Each order is said to be 150 characters long. 5 Launch Control Center crews, including those at Echo 01, open their locked safes bolted into the missile silo's concrete walls. Each launch officer compares the recently updated sealed authenticator system codes with the codes they've just received from the emergency action team at the National Military Command Center beneath the Pentagon. Each officer retrieves a fire control key, small, silver in color, made of metal, with a key ring and a descriptive tab. Each launch crew enters a war plan code into a launch computer, retargeting each of the ICBMs from open ocean default presets for safety to a predetermined target in the Option Charlie attack plan from the president's black book. 50 new target coordinates are typed in. Launch keys turn. 50 Minuteman III missiles, each with a 300-kiloton nuclear warhead in its nose cone, are now armed. 50 ICBMs, transporting a total of 15 megatons of explosive yield. Across the state of Wyoming, 50 110-ton concrete silo doors blow open wide. Through clouds of smoke and fire, 50 nuclear-armed missiles begin to rise. It takes 3.4 seconds for a Minuteman missile to exit its missile silo and take flight. After a minute, the first stage booster of each 80,000-pound missile completes powered flight and drops free. The second stage rocket booster ignites, dropping parts of itself as the missile climbs. After roughly 12 minutes, each missile will accelerate to extremely high velocities before reaching an ultimate cruising height of 500 to 700 miles above the surface of the Earth. But before any of these 50 ICBMs reach this final speed and height, a phone call gets made by an old man living down the road from one of these launch facilities here in Wyoming. The old man is a Russian spy. There are spies everywhere watching nuclear launch facilities across the United States. The CIA's first science and technology director, Dr. Albert Bud Whelan, told us before he died. The old Russian spy picks up his phone and calls Moscow. "The ICBMs have launched," he says into the phone. Part 3, the next 24 minutes. 24 minutes, Rancho San Miguelito, Point Bouchon, California. In central California on the coast, 4 miles northwest of the Diablo Canyon power plant, high on a hilltop near Point Bouchon, a cattle rancher is tending to his animals when he is blown off his feet by the blast from a 300-kiloton nuclear bomb. There was no sound at first, no warning, just a wall of dense air that hit him like a bulldozer, the wind ripping the clothes off his body. As fate and circumstance had it, the cattle rancher was facing away from the bomb when it exploded, sparing him blindness. He is alive, owing in part to geography, to the forms and features of the land surfaces around him. A series of low mountains and sloping cliff formations separate the rancher from ground zero, the point where the bomb detonated. The earth and stone buffered some of the bomb's deadly thermal radiation, light and heat that causes third-degree skin burns and sets combustible materials on fire, but not all. Large, hilly landmasses tend to increase air blast effects in some areas and to decrease them in others, U.S. Army scientists learned from the Hiroshima and Nagasaki bombings. There are no buildings here on this sea-facing bluff, nothing to topple over and crush the rancher to death, no glass windows to shatter and impale him. The overpressure from the bomb tore off his clothes and threw him to the ground. He is old as dirt and tough as hell. He gets to his feet, spins around. He sees the mushroom cloud. The rancher's great-grandfather purchased this land in the early 1900s, before the invention of Ford's automobile. staring at the mushroom cloud rising over the land. He almost can't believe his eyes. The rancher's cattle, their fur singed from thermal radiation, run for the hills. He stands alone, an old, naked man. He was born in July 1945, the same month and year that Manhattan Project scientists built and tested the first atomic bomb, codenamed Trinity, as in Father, Son, and Holy Ghost. The old rancher looks around for his clothes. He sees his smartphone in the dirt, spared localized EMP effects owing to the surrounding terrain. He picks up the remarkable little machine and begins taking video with its camera system. The old rancher knows history, knows the Trinity bomb was exploded in the Jornada del Muerto desert, which means the journey of the dead man. And now here he stands in Diablo Canyon, in the Devil's Gorge, watching the mushroom cloud expand. Everything associated with nuclear weapons is saturated in evil and in death, he has read in books. Always has been this way. He is old enough to remember when mutual assured destruction was first sold to the public as a savior, when really the old rancher knows that mad is madness. He remembers Bert the Turtle, duck and cover drills, Project Sunshine, that Atomic Energy Commission program that collected bones of the dead and baby teeth of living children to secretly test tissue in human body parts for levels of radiation exposure. The rancher keeps filming. He is aware of his own mortality, of the lethal levels of radiation he is no doubt receiving right now, of death by radiation poisoning, and how it is an abominable way to die. He uploads to Facebook more video, images of this grayish-brown mushroom cloud rising over a nuclear power plant sitting nearly equidistant between San Francisco and Los Angeles, between two of the most populous cities in America's most populous state. This is the devil's scenario made real. The bomb's localized electromagnetic pulse destroyed AC power systems up and down the coast, but the rancher's cell phone still has battery juice. It connects to the internet by way of a communication satellite passing overhead. The rancher's video posts to social media sites and begins making its way around the digital world. People in Paris and Peoria, in Karachi and Kuala Lumpur, are now seeing images of this mushroom cloud appearing across social media in near real time. Reports begin to flood the internet. Hashtag nuclear war. Hashtag Armageddon. Hashtag end of the world. 25 minutes. Data center, Sacramento, California. Tens of millions of people across America hurry to their smartphones and log on to social media platforms. If the internet is the road, the app is the destination, and in this moment people flood Facebook, X, Instagram, whatever their trusted news app happens to be, everyone desperate to gather information about what is happening on California's coast in real time. To see is to believe. People need to see the rancher's video with their own eyes. X is the first to implode. At its data center in Sacramento, the power shuts down. The backup systems kick in. Then those systems trip and shut down. The destruction of the Diablo Canyon power plant has wreaked havoc on California's electric grid. Demand is far outpacing supply. Computer servers and storage systems that process data begin to overload and start shutting off, falling like dominoes. 80, then 100, then 150 million of X's users log on all at once. The site buckles under the strain, crashes in entirety. X is now permanently and forever down. 25 minutes, 30 seconds, Diablo Canyon, California. The nuclear bomb that struck the Diablo Canyon power plant was a 300-kiloton surface burst. Unlike an air burst, which is designed to kill the most people on the ground using blast, a surface burst kills fewer people in the immediate vicinity, but produces far greater amounts of fallout than if exploded in the air. Fallout got its name because it literally falls out of the sky after the explosion passes and the shockwave subsides. The weapons technology involved in getting a KN-23 submarine-launched ballistic missile from a missile tube in an underwater vessel to a target on land has been decades in the making. The Americans and the Russians began working with sub-launched missile technology in the 1950s and have been at it ever since. North Korea is relatively new to the game, but thanks to theft and beginner's luck, the submarine-launched ballistic missile fired at the nuclear power plant in California missed the center point of its target by only a few football fields' distance. The bomb struck the earth and detonated just below the power plant's southernmost employee parking lot, 100 feet back from the edge of the cliff. Countless effects have been calculated by defense officials, including ones that involve hitting a nuclear reactor with a missile. But what has happened here is almost beyond measure. In a fraction of a second, everyone at the Diablo Canyon facility has been incinerated. There is no one left alive to measure anything. All nuclear power plants in the United States are built to withstand a direct hit from a fighter aircraft. In 1988, Sandia National Laboratories did a containment vessel integrity test, flying an F-4 Phantom fighter jet into a 12-foot concrete wall of approximate construction, a slab designed to simulate a reactor containment vessel wall. Most of the jet was atomized. The wall suffered a 2.3-inch scar. But this remotely controlled aircraft was traveling nearly 500 miles per hour, and its spare tanks were filled with water, not fuel. Hitting a nuclear reactor's containment vessel with a nuclear bomb is another league of destruction. When a 300-kiloton nuclear bomb detonates, it releases 300 trillion calories of energy within 1/1,000,000th of a second, a ridiculous amount of force for the average human mind to comprehend. In dynamite, that is the equivalent of 600 million pounds of TNT, a figure equally incomprehensible. A medium-sized pipe bomb has an explosive capacity of around 5 pounds. Historian Lynn Eden, scholar emeritus at Stanford University and an expert on nuclear firestorms, explains. Because the early fireball would be so hot, it would expand rapidly. By the time the fireball approached its maximum size, it would be more than a mile in diameter. A mile-wide nuclear fireball is enough to entirely destroy the 750-acre Diablo Canyon facility. And because roughly half that diameter area includes ocean, the entire nuclear power plant has now cratered into the sea. Everything inside the fireball is obliterated. Some of what used to be inside the crater gets deposited on the partial rim, with the rest carried up into the air to return to the earth as fallout. As Carl Sagan warned back in 1983, high-yield ground bursts will vaporize, melt, and pulverize the surface at the target area and propel large quantities of condensates and fine dust into the upper troposphere and stratosphere. And because this fireball vaporizes so much ground, its mushroom cloud contains an unprecedented amount of radioactive material. In The Effects of Nuclear Weapons, the Army's scientists did not mince words. A nuclear explosion occurring at or near the Earth's surface can result in severe contamination by the radioactive fallout, a gradual phenomenon extending over a period of time. Fallout can occur even when the cloud cannot be seen, with particles approximately 100 micrometers in diameter to pieces about the size of a marble. But the Army's description does not do justice to what is actually happening here. It does not include the cataclysmic effects that come with the dispersal into the atmosphere of the radioactive inventory from Diablo's twin 1,100 megawatt reactor cores and its 2,000 metric tons of intact spent fuel. Seconds pass. What is happening inside the mile-wide bomb crater is precisely what nuclear physicist Ralph E. Lapp warned about in the Ergen Report back in 1971. What remains of the twin reactor cores burns, spewing radioactive lava now boring down into the earth. Diablo's decommissioning panel previously warned that if temperatures were to reach 1,652 degrees Fahrenheit, 900 degrees Celsius, the hot fuel rods will spontaneously combust. And now they have. All of the more than 2,500 spent fuel assemblies burn, transforming into a radioactive brew of poisonous fallout. Minutes ago, the plant's open-air, dry-cask field of 58 concrete canisters stood upright like giant chess pieces, each one bolted down to a 7.5-foot-thick concrete pad. The bomb blast shattered their concrete shells, knocked them over, and blew them apart, and now they, too, emit extraordinary amounts of highly radioactive waste. Until the bomb struck, Diablo's reactor Unit 1 and Unit 2 were producing enough megawatts of electricity to deliver power to roughly 10% of all Californians, some 3.9 million people in 2024. Not anymore. Power plants require electricity to function. The bomb explosion has destroyed the AC power systems that once kept Diablo online, and the power isn't coming back anytime soon. The facility's 6 backup diesel generators were obliterated by the fireball, as were the fuel storage tanks and backup battery systems. The plant's on-site fire department, its 2 fire engines, water reservoirs, and the machines that pump seawater onto burning buildings, all have turned to ash. 5 million gallons of emergency water have been dispersed in the infernal heat. The plant's auxiliary seawater snorkels, its cooling water intake systems, and its hot water discharge areas have all collapsed into the sea. Emergency management helicopter crews will not arrive anytime in the near future to try to put the fires out, certainly not as Russian crews did during the Chernobyl disaster of 1986. The U.S. Army can't fly overhead and try to smother with sand and boron whatever might be left of the two exposed nuclear reactor cores. The high levels of lethal dose radiation pouring out of the site make passage through the debris cloud instantaneously lethal for weeks or months to come. Gordon Thompson, director of the Institute for Resource and Security Studies, describes the consequences of a spent fuel assembly fire. The fire cannot be extinguished at that point simply because it cannot be approached due to the extreme radioactivity. Thompson has studied nuclear fuel storage systems since 1978. His calculations indicate that up to 100% of the plant's radioactive fuel's elements would be released into the atmosphere. You're talking about an event that would force the long-term abandonment of an area roughly the size of New Jersey, Frank von Hippel tells us, then, confronted with this scenario, rephrases. Two New Jerseys. Los Alamos nuclear engineer Dr. Glenn McDuff paints an even darker picture. The situation would be far, far worse, he warns. Spent fuel rods are radioactive. Hit by a nuclear bomb, they would shatter into a zillion pieces. What this means, McDuff tells us, is that you'd now have radioactive pieces of spent fuel rods seeded in your fallout. You'd have a situation where the middle of California is unusable forever. The land could be contaminated all the way to Nevada, perhaps even Colorado. Diablo Canyon would never recover, ever. 26 minutes. National Defense Management Center, Moscow, Russia. Among the most significant people who managed to see and to download the cattle rancher's video before X went down are in Russia. They are the deputies serving the top generals in the Russian General Staff. This group of young officers in Moscow is now glued to electronic screens, replaying the mushroom cloud video in a loop. Here on the icy banks of the Moskva River, inside Russia's National Defense Management Center, every last person, from the generals to the janitors, has stopped what he or she was doing and now scrambles to make sense of what the hell is going on in the United States. The West Coast of America just got hit with a nuclear bomb. This is shocking. This is catastrophic. But most of all, this is terrifying. Deterrence is a psychological phenomenon, a state of mind. Now that deterrence has failed, anything can happen. Anything at all. It is 10:29 p.m. Moscow time. The night watch commander here the National Defense Management Center quickly sets up an emergency teleconference for the senior commanders of the general staff. Those who are already physically in the building rush into the control center of Strategic Nuclear Forces, an auditorium-style fortified command center similar to the bunker beneath the Pentagon in Washington, D.C. Russia had nothing to do with what just happened in the U.S. in this scenario. The ranking Russian generals signing into the teleconference one by one know this to be fact. They are the individuals in charge of the nation's nuclear forces. But conclusions drawn by others will be impossible to control. Deterrence has failed. The theory that mutual assured destruction keeps the world safe from nuclear weapons is no longer valid. In this moment of crisis, how will a decapitation event against the United States by a rogue third party impact decisions made by Russia's nuclear command and control. Former Secretary of Defense Leon Panetta provides us with his impression of what might be transpiring in such a moment. "I honestly don't think there's a great deal of thought given to the mad chemistry at a time like this." Panetta fears that when nuclear bombs start flying, there is not a lot of time to start thinking who the hell else is feeling threatened. There's not a lot of thought given to who the hell else may be thinking about doing what, not at a time like this. Crisis mindset can be a dangerous thing. The National Defense Management Center in Moscow is a nerve center of Russia's nuclear command and control. Located 2 miles from the Kremlin, here is where Russia's top generals can coordinate all military action around the world, including nuclear missile launches. The command bunker was designed to emulate the one beneath the Pentagon, only more grandiose. A floor-to-ceiling screen displays real-time military action on an electronic system bigger than an IMAX 180-degree digital dome, according to the Kremlin. Tablet computers connect military officers to a supercomputer in the basement. With its 16 petaflops of speed and 236 petabytes of storage capacity, the Kremlin claims their computer outperforms the Pentagon's 3-to-1. That, as Defense Minister Sergei Shoigu told TASS, Russian news agency, its colossal power allows it to run war games and make predictions about nuclear conflict with a human brain-like capacity designed to synchronize decision-making capabilities with real-world events. That it has the power to analyze the movements of other nations in near real time and to advise the Russian president about military actions to take in response. A bolt out of the blue nuclear attack levied against the United States is deeply troublesome to Russian nuclear command and control. The Night Watch commander picks up the phone and calls the general he reports to. "Vidozne nemadileno prehekt seyuda," he says. "You must get here immediately." 27 minutes in space. Up in space, thousands of miles above the Earth's surface, a technology-based disaster is underway. A Russian satellite at the apogee of its highly elliptical orbit is monitoring the northern tier Minuteman ICBM fields in the United States when the signal's intelligence it receives sets off a series of alarms. These classified warnings are the Russian equivalent of ballistic missile launch alert. For early warning missile launch detection from space, the U.S. Defense Department relies on SBIRS, a satellite system so technologically capable it sees the hot rocket exhaust on a single ICBM in a fraction of a second after launch. In an attempt at parity, Russia has built an early warning satellite system known as Tundra, a constellation of military satellites that claims to likewise be able to scan the sky above U.S. Minuteman missile fields and other places around the globe from space, to see in close to real time an enemy's or adversary's ICBM launch that threatens Russia with nuclear attack. But Tundra's capabilities are not anywhere near SBIRS capabilities, a weakness that Russia is loath to admit. Defense analysts generally agree that Russia's early warning satellite system is deeply flawed, which, in a moment such as this makes for a potentially deadly situation. Tundra is not great, says Pavel Podvig, the Western world's top expert on Russian nuclear forces, who works with the United Nations Institute for Disarmament Research. Ted Postel is blunt. Russian early warning satellites don't work accurately, he says. As a country, Russia doesn't have the technological know-how to build a system as good as we have in the United States. This means their satellites can't look straight down at the Earth, a technology known as look-down capability. And as a result, Russia's Tundra satellites look sideways, Postel warns, which handicaps their ability to distinguish sunlight from, say, fire. Notably troublesome is how Tundra sees clouds. Their satellites can mistake cirrus clouds for missile plumes that aren't there, Postel explains. And seeing missile plumes that aren't there opens the door for catastrophe. In a moment of heightened alarm, Moscow could think it's being attacked. If Russia thinks it's being attacked, the consequences would be dire. In a 2015 briefing on Capitol Hill, open to the public, called Accidental Nuclear War Between Russia and the United States, Postel told a group of congresspeople that Russia's fragile early warning system poses one of the greatest dangers of nuclear use that is currently facing the U.S. That if misinterpretation of satellite data were to happen, Russia could engage in a gigantic, spasmodic launch of all its nuclear forces. Former STRATCOM commander General Keeler warns us of what that could mean. Russia is the only country that can destroy the U.S. in the next couple of hours. 28 minutes. Marine 1, airborne over Bethesda, Maryland. Marine 1 races away from D.C. airspace as fast as the machine can physically fly. For a Sikorsky VH-92A, this means over 150 miles per hour. Inside, the president remains on comms with the chairman and the STRATCOM commander. With every minute that passes, the president's Marine One travels a little more than 2 miles farther away from the lethal proximity effects of the nuclear bomb that is rapidly descending on D.C. Still at the top of the list of threats to the president's life in this moment is electromagnetic pulse, the fast burst of electric current that likely will destroy all of Marine One's electronic systems and cause it to crash. The special agent in charge of the president's security detail has been focused on how to mitigate this threat, and now he has decided to take action. He instructs the three-man cat element to get ready to tandem jump the president out of the helicopter. Scientists have known about natural EMP events since the 1800s. Richard Garwin wrote the first paper on nuclear EMP in 1954 at Los Alamos. Its findings are classified. American defense scientists started paying more attention to its effects in 1962 after observing a nuclear weapons test in outer space called Starfish Prime. From post-blast measurements, it became clear that an EMP weapon exploded at high altitudes has the capability of permanently destroying large-scale infrastructure on the ground. During the Cold War, Russia live-tested an EMP in space over Kazakhstan, the former CIA Russia analyst and later EMP Commission Executive Director Dr. Peter Pry tells us. and that this high-altitude EMP destroyed all manner of electronics within an enormous footprint extending hundreds of miles on the ground below. When a nuclear bomb detonates closer to the ground, EMP effects are localized. The President's Marine One helicopter is EMP protected, but the equipment has only ever been tested in a chamber. No one knows what will actually happen in a real event. The President is being taken to the Raven Rock Mountain Complex, the Pentagon's alternate National Military Command Center, also known as Site R. The bunker was built during the Cold War. Its original plans were drawn by the Nazi engineer turned U.S. post-war Operation Paperclip scientist, George Riquet, whose credentials the American military admired and who had built Hitler's underground bunker in Berlin during the war. The distance from the White House to Site R is roughly 70 miles. Marine One usually takes around 30 minutes to get there, depending on takeoff and landing times. The commander-in-chief has been in the air for a little over 4 minutes. Not for another 4 or 5 miles will the helicopter be outside the dangerous overpressure zone. Marine One moves fast over Bethesda Hill, near where the interstate highway crosses Timberlawn Local Park. In the grass below, children playing on swing sets and slides get scooped up by terrified parents and babysitters as they receive word of a nuclear attack in California, everyone now racing to get home. Inside Marine One, over satellite comms, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff presses the president into action. 5 minutes remain on the red impact clock. The chairman of the Joint Chiefs is as certain as he is calm. Chairman, sir, we need from you the universal unlock code. President, what in hell is the universal unlock code? It is remarkable just how little a president of the United States knows about nuclear war. Stratcom commander, the U.S. has been attacked. The red impact clock continues to count down. Explanations at a time like this seem absurd. Chairman, I advise you to provide Stratcom with the universal unlock code, Mr. President, sir. If there were time to explain, it would go like this. In the words of former launch officer Bruce Blair and colleagues Sebastian Philippe and Sharon K. Weiner, if the president selects a limited nuclear option, a selective unlock code allows crews to fire specific missiles at specific targets and only those missiles. The trio are citing a feature called right of launch, a critical component of nuclear command and control that guarantees the president and only the president can ever authorize nuclear use. The selective unlock code acts as a safeguard. Unless, that is, the president overrides right of launch with the universal unlock code. Just as the adjectives suggest, this code would allow intercontinental ballistic missile and submarine crews to launch all of their nuclear weapons, Blair, Philippe, and Weiner tell us. Stratcom commander, we need the universal unlock code. America's ICBM crews have just launched 50 Minuteman missiles on the president's command. The submarine launch of another 32 nuclear warheads is underway. Should the president need to authorize a second nuclear strike, he must do so with new nuclear launch codes. Although the launch crews all have the keys necessary to fire additional nuclear weapons, the weapons experts explain, they lack the unlock codes needed to arm, target, and fire those weapons. If a second launch needs to occur, multiple different unlock codes would have to be sent to the launch crews. And for that, the National Security Agency must create entirely new codes. Right of launch ensures that if the president authorizes the use of 82 nuclear warheads, crews launch 82 warheads, not 83 and not 84. The STRATCOM commander tells the president that STRATCOM assumes the position that there will likely be additional missile strikes against the United States, and STRATCOM will need to respond. The chairman is blunt. If the president dies, STRATCOM cannot launch additional missiles, unless STRATCOM has the universal unlock code. The president stares out Marine One's window. In the middle of the mayhem, a thought occurs. "Where's the VP?" the president asks. If the president dies, authority transfers to the vice president, who, as second in the line of succession, is also accompanied 24/7, 365 by a mill aide carrying a football. National Security Advisor. The VP was at Arlington Cemetery laying a wreath on a grave. Movement is underway, but... Chairman, with line of succession in jeopardy, we need the universal unlock code. This is the razor's edge, like the W. Somerset Maugham novel of the same name, the story of a World War I pilot so traumatized by the carnage of war, he rejects war in pursuit of the meaning of life. The sharp edge of a razor is difficult to pass over, thus the wise say the path to salvation is hard. Contemplating the reality of the universal unlock code, the president is incentivized. If he learned about any of this during his president-elect briefing, he doesn't recall. Now it seems profound. If the world is going to end in nuclear holocaust, he'd rather not be the one with a billion or more people's blood on his hands. The president authorizes the universal unlock code. In the event the president or his successor becomes unlocatable, nuclear launch decisions can be made directly by the STRATCOM commander now. 31 minutes, National Military Command Center, Pentagon. Inside the nuclear bunker beneath the Pentagon, 120 seconds remain until a nuclear bomb detonates over the building, obliterating everyone and everything with a violence and a permanence that is as catastrophic as it is absurd. All 27,000 personnel who work here are about to die. This includes all the headquarters command staff for the Army, the Navy, the Air Force, the Marine Corps, the Space Force, the Coast Guard, the 11 U.S. combatant commands, many of the 17 intelligence agencies, and tens of thousands of other humans. And this is just at the Pentagon. Unless, that is, North Korea's nuclear warhead fails upon reentry, which it could. The Hwasong-17 has traveled 6,000 miles from Pyongyang. It has reached speeds of 15,000 miles per hour and a cruising altitude of 700 miles. It has gone through boost and mid-course phases. All four U.S. interceptor missiles that tried to shoot it down missed. Now the nuclear warhead must re-enter Earth's atmosphere. This is a critical time. One where failure is commonplace. Reentry is an area where so many different things can go wrong, Los Alamos weapons engineer Glenn McDuff tells us. It has to be precise, spinning like a bullet. If the reentry vehicle gets off target, loses flight stability, it doesn't reenter, it burns up. For years, the CIA remained convinced that North Korea's ballistic missiles did not have reentry capability. Then, in 2020, for reasons not made public, their assessment changed. So many lives hang in the balance. Will reentry succeed or fail? 32 minutes, SecDef and vice chairman in the Osprey. Seated inside the V-22 Osprey, barreling toward Site R, the Secretary of Defense has been listening in on satellite comms. But his focus is on Russia. He is determined to speak with the President of the Russian Federation. Beside him in the aircraft, the Vice Chairman is on the line with an officer from the Defense Information Systems Agency, a critical special mission support unit. DISA is the combat support agency charged with connecting the entire force of Defense Department employees, over 4 million users, to the Defense Information System Network worldwide. Through its Joint Staff Support Center, DISA operates and maintains the National Joint Operations Intelligence Center inside the Pentagon and at Site R. With the Pentagon just seconds away from complete annihilation, all emergency operations and communications have switched over to Site R. DISA's critical special mission support personnel are relaying everything they can, as fast as they can, to the Vice Chairman and the Secretary of Defense. The SecDef and Vice Chairman have been in the air for 14 minutes, and they are already almost twice as far out of DC airspace as Marine One. The V-22 Osprey is a significantly faster aircraft, larger, and with a much greater wingspan. On each wingtip, a 38-foot diameter, three-blade composite rotor is attached to a rotating nacelle, each able to swivel up to 90 degrees in the vertical direction when the plane operates as a helicopter. This feature allows the Osprey to land and take off vertically, like a conventional helicopter, but also gives it the power to fly twice as fast as most other helicopters by rotating its nacelles forward and converting itself into a turboprop plane. Because the Osprey left the Pentagon before the President left the White House lawn, and because the Osprey is faster, it is already out of the dangerous overpressure zone, which means the SecDef and the Vice Chairman have a much greater chance of making it to the Raven Rock Mountain Complex alive than the President does. So much has happened in the last 32 minutes. So much depends on what happens next. But the SecDef remains focused on one thing, getting the Russian president on the line. Like many who become the U.S. Secretary of Defense, the SecDef in this scenario has spent his life working within the military-industrial complex. This makes him uniquely aware of an existential peril that exists. A terrifying flaw in mutual assured destruction. A kind of hole over the North Pole. A weakness that is well known to nuclear weapons experts like Hans Christensen, but largely ignored by the rest of the world. The Minuteman III ICBM does not have enough range to target North Korea without overflying Russia, Christensen explains. Meaning 50 ICBMs launched from missile fields in Wyoming must travel on a trajectory that flies directly over Russia. The whole, it's very dangerous, former Secretary of Defense Leon Panetta confirms. I don't think people give it enough thought. At the time of this scenario, relations between the U.S. and Russia, two nuclear-armed superpowers, are at an all-time low. Paranoia is high. In this scenario, the U.S. president is not on friendly terms with the president of the Russian Federation. And now, nuclear weapons have been launched by the United States at North Korea in a counterattack, and they must fly over Russia to get there. This is a recipe for disaster. In this scenario, the Secretary of Defense fears, with very good reason, that if he doesn't reach the Russian president immediately, as in now, a cascading series of new nightmare events could unfold. 32 minutes, 30 seconds. Osan Air Base, Republic of Korea, South Korea. In an underground bunker at Osan Air Base in South Korea, a U.S. Air Force colonel stares at a satellite image on a screen in front of her. Few U.S. military bases in the world remain on as permanent a high alert status as Osan. Their defense posture is literally ready to fight tonight. In the nuclear conflict now unfolding, South Korea is almost certainly a next target. The U.S. colonel watches the screen in front of her. Beside her is her South Korean counterpart. Analysts have identified movement along the border with North Korea, less than 50 miles from the bunker here. On Osan's tarmac, F-16 Fighting Falcons and A-10 Thunderbolts taxi down the runways as American and South Korean pilots prepare for combat. U.S. Army Black Hawk helicopters prep sling loads for disbursement to smaller, forward operating locations. Everyone, from the pilots to the maintenance crews to the soldiers who pump gas, is suited up in chemical, biological, and radiation protection gear. The intelligence community estimates that as of 2024, North Korea has roughly 50 nuclear bombs. North Korea is also understood to maintain the largest chemical weapons stockpile anywhere in the world, 5,000 tons worth, much of it preloaded onto rockets. Osan Air Base is always ready for combat. With its sister facility, Camp Humphreys, located 12 miles to the south, the U.S. military maintains its mission in Korea of providing a ring of safety around Seoul. Seoul is the largest megacity in the developed world and is situated just 40 miles to the north of Osan Air Base. With its 9.6 million residents, Seoul is among the most densely populated cities on Earth, with roughly 1 million more people than New York City. The Seoul capital area has 26 million people. Half the country lives here. To protect the Osan Air Base from missile attack, the base relies on the terminal high-altitude area defense system, the multi-billion-dollar system designed to detect and shoot down incoming missiles. But every weapon system has holes. THAAD's weakness is that it cannot handle volume. THAAD systems are set up to engage several targets at a time, says military historian Reed Kirby, not hundreds of them. Kirby consults for non-governmental organizations on North Korea's weapons of mass destruction capabilities. The U.S. Air Force colonel in the bunker stares at the satellite images, eyes peeled for signs of movement along the border with the North, for signs of a dreaded chemical weapons saturation attack. 32 minutes, 30 seconds. Marine One, airborne. There is chaos in Marine One. Some of the individuals on board are shouting,